If you're not keeping score, you're just practicing, you're not playing.
That's Goiko Adjic, partner at Neuri Consulting, sharing his insights on how to build a great product.
I find a lot of joy in programming. Programming is one of the best things I can do to lift my spirits up and enjoy my day.
Goiko Adjic is one of the 2019 AWS Serverless Heroes, the winner of the 2016 European Software Testing Outstanding Achievement Award and the 2011 Most Influential Agile Testing Professional Award. Goiko's book, Specification by Example, won the Jolt Award for the Best Book of 2012, and his blog won the UK Agile Award for the Best Online Publication in 2010. Goiko is a frequent speaker at software development conferences and one of the authors of MindMap and NaraKit. Building products is what we explore in this episode of Le Podcast on Emerging Leadership. The podcast equips you to unlock the power of emerging leadership. Each episode turns insight into actions that you can use straight away to build momentum and create lasting change from yourself to your team, from your team to other teams, and from other teams to the entire organization. I'm your host, Alexis Monville, and I believe in the ability of people and teams to find better ways to increase their impact and satisfaction. Let's jump right into the conversation with Goiko to learn more about what it means. Hey, Goiko, glad to have you here. How are you? And can you tell us a little bit more about you and your background?
Hey, wonderful to be on the show. I'm a developer currently working on two products. I've worked as a consultant. I wrote some books. Effectively, I really like coding. And since I started on a developer job 20-something years ago, I've realized that in order to do good coding, I have to learn how to do good testing, how to do good product management, and a bunch of other things. And my interests seem to be going around in a spiral. I tend to learn a lot about doing some coding thing, and then that leads me to making more complex products. So I need to learn more about how to test it well. That leads me to figuring out, well, how do I reduce the amount of things I need to do in order to do all of this well? So I need to learn more about product management, and then it gives me more capacity to do more development and start new products. So it's kind of going on in a spiral, and every time I touch one of these subjects, I end up writing a book about it, I guess, as a way of doing a memory dump so I can free more random access memory for myself.
I love the way you are describing that. And I love the fact that it's a virtuous spiral that is leading to more books, because I really enjoyed reading your books. So that's a really good news. Of course, one of those books that I'm using really a lot is Impact Mapping. Can you tell us a little bit more about what led you to that book and probably, what is impact mapping? Yeah, you will need to explain that.
What led me to that book is I was a CTO of a company that basically ran into a wall and spent all the money that it could spend. And it did that in the worst possible time, where kind of 2008, 2009, it was almost impossible to get any good investment, and we ran out of money. And I was a minority investor in that company as well, so I didn't take any salary, and I was left almost without the money to pay the rent next month. That's how stupid I was. And we were incredibly, incredibly efficient in terms of software production. It was by far the best team I've ever worked with, even till today, in terms of technical competence. And we were doing things that became buzzwords later before they had a name. So we were doing stuff like continuous delivery before, people knew the continuous delivery buzzword. We were doing cloud-based deployments back then. We were doing almost 100% automated testing. And it was wonderful. The code quality was wonderful, but we delivered no value. So, because we were really, really efficient, we really efficiently burned through our whole budget. And as a CTO of that company, I was really embarrassed when it came to the point that I had to admit to myself what we're doing is wrong. Because I thought we were doing so well. You know, up until then, I really focused on the technical quality of what the product is. And I've realized that there's a lot more. And as a technical person, I need to engage a lot more with product people. And not in a sense of not trusting them, but in a sense of being able to more efficiently challenge their ideas and help them make better decisions. And help facilitate a discussion between technology and product. And that led me to kind of a lot of research and trying to figure out what we did wrong. And I started studying kind of the emerging discipline of product management in software and how kind of people do product management and deal with assumptions. And that's, I think, roughly around the time when the Lean Startup book came out and the software world really started awakening to how much we waste on stupid kind of work and stupid products. And one of the really wonderful things about software for me is it's almost like magic. You know, you literally turn ideas into products. You sit and drink coffee and turn something you have in the back of your head with some magic words. You know, we don't use abracadabra, we use const var. And for each and things like that. But that's magic. Create products out of nothing. But at the same time, if what we build is missing the point, then you can spend a ton of cash and it just vaporizes. It disappears in thin air. There's nothing to show for it. And research I was doing back then to figure out what we did wrong and how would I never repeat that mistake in my life led me to learn about this technique called effect cortening that the in-use agency in Sweden was developing. And I just saw how incredibly wonderful that is for facilitation. And the reference book for what they were talking about then was in Swedish. There was an English version of that book, but wasn't that popular. And really, I have very high respect for in-use people, and I don't want this to sound like I'm disparaging them, but I don't think the book was accessible to the average software developer or the average software stakeholder. And I decided that I'm going to first try this out, and trying it out, I saw how good it can be, and then decided to kind of write a book that will make this technique more approachable to people, especially doing iterative software delivery. And that's basically the story of the book.
Excellent. I love the story, and I love it's anchored in something that is really important to you. People always love to talk about their successes and how great they were, but it's always interesting to learn about something that didn't really work well in the end. So, and what you can learn from that is really important. So I love the story behind the book.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's so much wasted potential today in what we do as an industry. I mean, if you look at how much software gets produced how much energy and how much effort people spend building these things, and then you look at the result of some of these efforts, most of it is just kind of mediocre. Most of it doesn't go anywhere. A lot of it is kind of pointless. And it's very difficult to even know in the short term if what we're delivering makes sense or not. One of the kind of best examples of this, a few years ago, there was a project at the British Broadcasting Corporation where it was shut down. It was a personalization project for the video player. And it was shut down after a few years when they spent something like, I think, £75 million. I can find the link and send it to you so you can attach it in the podcast. I don't remember exactly now. I think it was about £75 million, something like that. It was shut down because it delivered no value. And because this is a publicly funded corporation, it's a public broadcaster, the government office of national audit got involved to figure out how can you possibly spend so much money on software and deliver no value. And the conclusion at the end, I'll send you the link to that so you can put it in the podcast links for your audience, was that they could do it because it was agile. And what that meant is that every month what they delivered, somebody was evaluating to say, well, you know, is this good? Is it bad? Is it valuable? And the stakeholders were deluding themselves where they were making the decision if something was valuable or not. And, you know, it was basically somebody in the company told some developers, well, I want this feature, then deliver the feature and say, well, is it valuable? They say, well, yeah, that's what I asked you to do. And it's completely pointless. It's just running around in circles and having no way to actually understand if we're going in the right direction or not. And I think impact mapping is the easiest solution I found to that problem. It's not the best solution. There are probably better solutions out there, but they're very, very academic, very difficult to apply. The most popular process for goal-driven requirements engineering in the academia is something called ISTAR. And the basic book on ISTAR is about 600 or 700 pages. You know, it must provide some wonderfully precise way of measuring value, but I don't think any of the people I ever worked with would understand that and have time for it, where impact mapping is something that you can explain in 10, 15 minutes to business stakeholders, and one afternoon later, they will already have an impact map. And that's what I love about the practice. It's kind of fast, it's collaborative, and it really helps people solve an actual problem.
Can you explain impact mapping in a few minutes for us?
Absolutely. So impact mapping is a visualization technique that helps developers, business stakeholders, product representatives, analysts, UX people, people from different backgrounds, have a really good conversation on how the plan or proposed deliverables connect to the value, and how do we know that we're going the right direction? What is the value of what we're going to deliver? And they help people visualize the big picture for what needs to be achieved and create a good way of measuring if we're going the right direction or not. Impact mapping does that by connecting the business goals through impacts, through changes to the user's behavior or changes to kind of the customer's behavior and to the deliverables. So it presents this middle layer that helps us measure change in a short term. What's really wonderful about that is that behavior changes are observable on a shorter time scale. So if we change some, you know, software over there and people start staying longer on the website, or they start interacting better with their friends, or they can administer Linux systems easier, or they can create larger server farms faster, then we're delivering value. And behavior change is something that can be measured in the short term. It can be measured with a trial population of users. It can provide the leading indicator of value. And that's why it's so important. And, you know, I remember reading Michael Jackson's book, of course, the kind of software architect, not the singer. I don't think the singer wrote any books. And about problem frames, probably 20 years ago or even more. And he said that kind of one of the biggest problems in software delivery is creating a connection between the kind of problem machine and the solution machine. And impact mapping creates a connection between the kind of problem world and the solution world through these impacts and behavior changes, and allows us to see where we're going, allows us to measure what we're doing makes sense, and allows us to focus on solving problems instead of just delivering solutions.
That sounds really easy said this way, and I think it's exactly why the approach is so useful. It's because it's really easy. And once you started asking yourself the questions, it really helps you to do exactly that. Connect the impact you want to achieve with the solution you want to bring. And that's really, really helpful. I love that.
So, you know, that one of the books I really love, I've read this book a few years ago, and I'm really sorry I've not discovered it a longer time ago, is Four Disciplines of Execution. For people that have been doing good product management or kind of iterative delivery in a good way, there's nothing revolutionary new in the book, but they've explained things so well. It's amazing. So I think even if you are kind of the total expert in your field, it's worth reading that book, because the book is so well written and the ideas are so well explained that it's totally amazing. And they boil down the difference between organizations that are excellent in executing their plans compared to organizations that are not good at executing their plans, to kind of four big differences. The first big difference, or the first kind of discipline of execution, is focus on the wildly important, which is really, you know, keep your eyes on the ball and focus on the goal and work towards that. Impact mapping helps with that because you have this one goal at the center of the map and you're really focusing on delivering that. I've worked with organizations where once we start creating an impact map and have, you know, 50, 60 ideas in a backlog connected to a single impact, and the first two epics deliver the impact, then we can just say, look, we don't have to do the other 48. We're focused on the goal. We're not focused on delivering the solution. We're focused on delivering the results, and we've delivered the results. So let's move on. The second thing they talk about is focus on leading metrics of value, on leading indicators of value. They say that every organization can very easily measure at the end if an initiative succeeded or failed. If you start something to increase your market share or increase revenue or increase profit, 6 months after you finish or a year after you finish, you will be able to know if you did it or not. Very easily. The measurements are there. But those measurements are irrelevant, really, for knowing what should we do next week. Like, if you have 50 user stories that address the same impact, which of these user stories should you do and which you shouldn't do? You can't know that if you only measure the results 6 months later. If you're like the BBC in the iPlayer project and you know, 4 years later, you know, you wasted £75 million, that's game over. We need leading indicators of value. And impact mapping helps incredibly with that because it provides this glue layer in between that is these impacts that we can start measuring. Are we going in the right direction or not? And there's a wonderful story from Mark Schwartz in his book, The Art of Business Value, where they talk about this project they've done at the U.S. Immigration Services, where it was a massive, massive government project, but they looked at how many cases a human caseworker can process per day. And that's a leading indicator of value that then you can focus on. And they were measuring the behavior change for these people. So every time they deliver a piece of software, they were measuring if humans are processing more cases per day. If yes, we are delivering value. If not, what we delivered is incomplete, pointless, damaging, whatever. And impact maps help amazingly with that. The third discipline of execution that they talk about in the book is to create a team scoreboard. Create a way for the team that delivers to know, are they going in the right direction or not? Not to have to wait on external feedback from some third party that 3 years later says, well, this is valuable or not. But look at really focusing on providing value to the people, that providing information to people that deliver so they can make better decisions. And they have a wonderful quote in the book. I love it. They say, if you're not keeping score, you're just practicing, you're not playing. And for a lot of organizations, we throw some software against the wall. We have no idea if it delivers any value or not. And again, impact maps help with that because they make it clear, well, this story is related to this impact. Our scoreboard, the way we measure the score should be, is this impact happening or not? And this opens up some really, really interesting discussions that can happen. There's a wonderful piece of research, and I'll give you the link. I think it's interesting for your readers to understand as well, from Microsoft, where a guy called Ron Kohavi went to analyze if the stuff that was promised in PowerPoints actually came true for some initiatives. And his conclusion was that about one third of initiatives that they looked at actually moved the numbers they were supposed to move in the right direction. About one third actually created no statistical impact on the numbers they were supposed to improve. And about one third actually damaged the numbers they were supposed to improve. So, you know, Microsoft is a pretty good software development company. And if you look at it from that perspective, you know, they don't get things always right. And of course, they don't get things always right because their business people are not, you know, clairvoyant. They don't have a crystal ball. They don't control the competition. They don't control the market. And creating this scoreboard allows us to actually see in a shorter cycle, are we delivering or not? And the fourth discipline of execution they talk about is creating a good cadence of accountability. The last discipline they talk about in the book is creating a cadence of accountability. And really, that means reviewing the plans as we're going along very frequently and being honest about are we delivering value or not. Being honest about is what we're doing providing what we expected it to provide. And if not, then there's something unexpected going on. Then we need to do a bit more research. We need to inspect whether there's something blocking our users from realizing the value we expected, or maybe, you know, the ideas we had are just bad ideas. And from that perspective, impact mapping really helps connect all these things together. And it's a wonderful visualization technique that's really simple. And you said it was easy. I think there's a nice distinction we need to start making between simple and easy. I think impact mapping is simple as a way we can explain it in 15 minutes. I don't think it's incredibly easy to do. There are some challenges about doing it. It's not too difficult to do, but it's much, much easier to do than a lot of other very complex bureaucratic things. And that's why I love it.
Yeah, that's true. It's simple to understand. It can be hard to get to a map that you really like. The thing is, it's easy to start. You can have something really fast. It will not be perfect, but if you accept that, you will keep that map and you will continue to improve it. You have something you can work on, and you can improve it. And it's convenient to visualize it, and it really helps with prioritization and saying, okay, we will focus on that particular impact now. And that's good. We are good with that. So, yep, you're right. It's simple. It's not necessarily easy.
Well, one of the things I think, you know, helped me a lot was reading Doug Hubbard's book on how to measure anything. That's kind of when I was doing this research for my benefit on how do we get good business metrics out. I came across that book, and it's a wonderful book. And in the book, he talks about how lots of people discard metrics that are not perfect because they don't kind of totally eliminate uncertainty. And he says that good metrics don't necessarily need to eliminate uncertainty. It's very difficult to eliminate uncertainty, but good metrics help reduce uncertainty. So I think impact mapping is one of these things where it will reduce uncertainty. And the more you do it, the more it will reduce uncertainty. And even if you start and you don't get the perfect map, you don't get like the totally mathematically correct thing you need to do, it's useful, as you said, because it's better than what people were doing before. So it reduces it a bit.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. When we scheduled the call, you told me that you were available before a certain time in the day, because after that you were pair programming. And of course, I'm really interested in collaboration and in close collaboration like pair programming. Is it something that you are always doing, pair programming, or is it something that you are doing just for the moment for a specific product you are working on?
I work on two products at the moment. One is relatively kind of successful and more stable. We've been developing that since 2013. And there are two people working on that product. There's me and a colleague of mine, Dave DeFlorinier, and we pretty much pair program all the time on it because that allows us to share the knowledge of what's going on, and that allows us to create a better product. That allows us to keep each other honest and not cheat and not cut corners. And it genuinely leads to much better design because we can have two pairs of eyes looking at something instead of one pair of eyes, and we develop this product that basically runs on its own. It doesn't require almost any support, and it allows me to kind of travel around when there's no corona and the planes are flying, and it allows David to do his own things in his time. So it's very important for us that the quality of the product is allowing us to work at a sustainable pace. Because there's only two of us, we cannot spend time fielding customer kind of support calls or fixing bugs and things like that, because then we're not producing value on the product. So what comes out has to be really, really good. And I think pair programming is absolutely critical for that. Having said that, I honestly enjoy programming more on my own. I find a lot of joy in programming. Programming is one of the best things I can do to lift my spirits up and kind of enjoy my day. And pair programming can be brutal. It can be very difficult because you're always having to explain everything you're doing. And I found that I cannot get really immersed in the problem. I can't get in the flow if I'm pair programming. As I said, it does produce a better product. And from a product development perspective, it's the right thing to do. From a enjoyment perspective, I also like spending a long period of time just on my own, listening to music and very quietly being immersed in a problem and trying to solve it. And that's kind of what brings me into the flow. So I think that's the other product I'm building is a very young one. I kind of literally launched it commercially less than 6 months ago. I think in October, it launched commercially. In April last year, it launched as a beta. It's a video editing tool that is aimed at people who are not video editing professionals and they want to very quickly create a video from assets such as images or screenshots. And it does, for developers and techie people in particular, it's really good because it allows you to convert a markdown file into a video, which means you can have video under version control. And it helped me a lot doing stuff for the previous product, actually. That's how I came with the idea because there's only two of us. We have to do programming, we have to do support, we have to do sales, we have to do product management. And one of the things I ended up doing is creating videos for users to learn how to use the product. And then every time we change something small on the screen, I have to re-record everything again. And because I'm not a video editing professional, doing a 5-minute demo video takes me 2 or 3 hours, or took me 2 or 3 hours. So I started looking for ways to automate that. And then I figured out, well, you know, I can just automatically compose screenshots into video. And I even kind of integrate with text-to-speech engines that have improved significantly over the last kind of 5 or 6 years. And they can do English better than I can. I mean, I can't get rid of my Bond villain accent. So if you hear me speaking in a video, that's not as nice as hearing a nice kind of a gentle voice that speaks in a perfect English accent. And I can do that with machine learning voices now. So basically, you get a markdown document, you compile it, and it gives you a video. And then I realized when I automated it for this other thing, there's a product here. So I've kind of extracted that into a separate product and launched it. And for that, I'm programming on my own. And I enjoy that immensely. So I can spend, you know, 10 hours immersed in a problem and not notice how much time has passed. And I realized if I work on my own, I enjoy it a lot more, but pair programming creates a better product.
This is excellent. So the first product is MindMap, right?
Yes, the first product is MindMap. It's a mind mapping tool for mostly used by schools and universities. We have some kind of project management cases and also kind of some people are using it for describing the testing plans and outlining books and writing, but it's mostly used in the educational setting.
Yeah, and the second one is Narakit.
The second one is Narakit, yes, exactly. Thank you very much for kind of investigating so much. That's amazing.
Yeah, I have to admit that I'm really excited about Narakit because I wanted to have a short video to explain something. And now that I know that I can even just create a slide in Google Slide and start from there, I'm really excited about it. I'm working on it right now.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Yeah, so, you know, it started as a bunch of shell scripts, actually, to get everything. And I have this flaw in my mind where if I see something that I do 5 times, because I'm lazy in a good way, I don't like repeating myself. And if I see something I do 5 times manually, I kind of have an urge to automate it with shell scripts. And I've done, you know, this thing actually started as a shell script and then evolved into a nice web service for people. So I'm really glad you can use that as well.
This is really good. This is really good. I have a question for you. When we are in close collaboration with someone, it's sometimes a little bit difficult to get things across in the right way. How do you deal with that? How do you deal with the potential conflicts? How do you deal with not being on the same page when you work so closely with people?
So I have two kind of techniques I tend to apply to resolve situations like that. One is, I don't know who I stole this idea from. So I can't really give you the exact source of this, but I think I stole it from Michael Bolton. Again, the tester, not the singer, of course. Yeah. Kind of the idea that I phrase it like now, I think he phrased it slightly differently, is that it's much easier for people to complain than to tell you what they want. So if I'm working with people and I can't really get them to say what they actually want, I throw something that I know that they're going to complain about. Like I propose something idiotic. And then we get to a good conversation that actually makes sense. The other technique that really helps me clarify things is to offer realistic examples. And I think examples of how something is supposed to work, examples of how we might want to use something are, again, concrete enough for people to really understand that there's an additional case here, or we've not covered everything, or we need to discuss something in a bit better way. And examples are a wonderful technique. This goes back all the way to, I think, Jerry Weinberg's work on exploring requirements from 1989 or even longer, on giving people something that is concrete that everybody can agree on. In a kind of complex organization that delivers a product, you have people from lots of different backgrounds, and they all use different sources of truth and different forms of explaining information. UX designers use wireframes, developers use code, testers use some kind of testing scripts, business people use PowerPoints, and it's very difficult for all of them to agree on anything, but everybody can talk about realistic examples. And that's something that has turned out to be an almost like universal tool for good communication.
Excellent. Is this the root ideas that led to write the book Specification by Examples?
I think so, yeah. I kind of, you know, Spec by Example, again, came out of a slightly different journey for me where I was working for a company where they had lots of database developers who only looked at kind of Oracle PL/SQL code and application developers who looked at Java back then, I guess, or C# wasn't out yet properly. And business analysts who wrote all these kind of long documents where nobody was reading them. And I was really trying to figure out, how do we avoid the long testing cycles, and how do we avoid getting stuck in something that kind of we deliver, and at the end, it turns out it was the wrong thing. And that led me that back then to discover, I think, fit from Walt Cunningham and fitness that came around that time. And I started thinking about this from a perspective of, this is going to help us automate testing. But I realized there's so much more to this, and it's actually kind of a good communication technique, and test automation really becomes secondary. Once you have a good understanding, it's easy to good tests, but kind of the tests almost become secondary. So the book Spec by Example came out of kind of that learning journey. I told you earlier, I think, you know, once I remove a bottleneck with me doing code, I realize something else is a bottleneck. And in that case, testing was the bottleneck. So I had to learn how to do good testing. And that led me to kind of this whole idea of what was back then example-driven development or acceptance test-driven development. Behavior-driven development as a phrase didn't exist yet back then. I think Dan North came up with that phrase around the same time. And most people would call that stuff behavior-driven development now. But that was a very interesting situation where we actually, you know, I think XP, when XP became popular or started becoming popular early 2000s, developers were the first to jump on the train, and then we removed the bottleneck. Lots of organizations removed the bottleneck from development, and then they all realized, well, you know, the next bottleneck is testing. And as Jerry Weinberg says, once you solve your number one problem, your number two problem gets a promotion. Kind of, I think the community then invested a lot in solving this kind of developer tester communication gap. And that's what led me to examples and spec by example.
Yeah, it's excellent. I love the idea of looking at the whole process and looking at the bottlenecks. You remove the first bottleneck on development, you have a bottleneck on testing, and then you can say, oh yeah, we need to deliver. You solve the bottleneck on delivery. Oh, that's absolutely perfect. And then you realize that you are not delivering the right product. And you are going back to the beginning saying, okay, what is the missing link between the users and the value they want and the product, the definition of the product itself. And you solve that other problem. It's interesting how you connected all those dots. I love it.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's not cyclical. I think it's an upward going spiral. You know, you solve one problem and then it takes you to another problem. And I think our industry is very cyclical, but the cycles are quite long. If you look at what's happening now in the kind of technical infrastructure space, in essence, we're almost back to the time of mainframes, or the time of mainframes is coming back again. You know, in 70s and early 80s, before the PC revolution, people were renting effectively CPU cycles from mainframes with timeshare and things like that. And now you have people renting CPU cycles from Amazon or Google or Microsoft, either using virtual machines or using serverless functions now. And in a sense, you know, it's a much, much better mainframe and much more accessible mainframe than it was before, but it's timeshare. We're coming back to that. And
exactly.
It'll be really interesting, you know, after this timeshare, there's going to be the new equivalent of the PC revolution or something like that, where we go back to, you know, client server software in some new way. My best guess is it's going to be client server software on very small devices like IoT or things like that. That's kind of emerging. And we're going to end up in really silly situations and some wonderful situations. You can already see some examples of that. I think there was an outage at Amazon in the US East 1 region. That's kind of the first Amazon cloud that went up in North Virginia. There was an outage a few months ago where the message distribution system Kinesis that they use brought down a bunch of other services, and there were people locked out of their homes because they had these smart lock devices that were talking to the Amazon cloud. And now you have this mainframe going down and people can't go into their homes. And that's ridiculous. So, you know, after the mainframe, we're going to go back to smarter clients because, you know, if the cloud goes down, you still need to go back to your home, obviously. So yeah. I think it's cyclical, but the cycles are slow and people don't really notice them that much.
Yeah, I think we during the PC revolution, people were mocking the. I don't remember who was the person at IBM that said, well, we will probably need 5 computers in the world at the beginning of the computer story. And people were mocking those, saying, yeah, you can see how many computers we have now. But yeah, from a big mainframe perspective, we are probably on our way to have 5 big computers on the planet.
Well, you know, there's three computers that maybe 4 computers that really matter. I don't know enough about the Asian market. So, but really, you know, you have Amazon and Microsoft and Google. And I think, unfortunately, IBM kind of missed the game. It's incredible how IBM kind of totally missed the mobile and the web and the cloud. And it's very interesting to see if they will kind of catch up. Oracle kind of is trying to build their own cloud, but I don't know anybody who's using that. And you effectively have 3 computers that matter. And maybe there's Alibaba or somebody like that in China. I'm not really sure about that market. I think that's an emerging market. And I need to learn more about that. But yeah, we're coming back to, you know, 3 or 4 computers effectively and everybody else having dumb terminals that connect to that.
Yeah, and the smart computer at the edge, that's exactly that edge revolution because, yeah, the example you mentioned about not being able to go back to your home, That's exactly what you don't want when you have a car, and the car is the intelligence should be in the car, and some of the data should be in the car, because you want the car to be able to brake or find its way to some places without the need to be connected to the connected to the network.
And things are so connected that it's ridiculous now. You have, I remember in like 2 or 3 years ago, Amazon S3 went down for a couple of hours, I think. And like he took down half of the internet with it. He took down Reddit. He took down a bunch of other services. So everything is connected to everything else now. And that's amazing, because you have this kind of information distribution that, you know, anywhere you go in the world, you carry all the world's knowledge in your pocket, effectively. But because everything is connected to everything else, a crucial service like that going down for a couple of hours might mean, yeah, cars stop working now. And that's ridiculous. So, yeah, we are going back to those cycles. But kind of the reason why I mentioned this, I think, is we're having the same type of cycles, I think, in the software development world as well, because, you know, we unlock one bottleneck as a community, and that changes the context, and then we go and unlock another bottleneck, and then at some point kind of it comes back. So, you know, I fully expect at some point that programming will become the bottleneck again, and then we'll have to come up with much, much better techniques for programming, or better languages, or better ways of doing things. And you know, whether that's because everybody settled on JavaScript, that is like the worst possible language you can think of in terms of language design, but it's incredibly productive for people, and, you know, it runs everywhere. So now we have these, you know, monstrosities like TypeScript that's trying to kind of fix it, and WebAssembly that's trying to kind of allow compilation of JavaScript and other things. And maybe, you know, when it comes back to that, we'll have better languages finally to work that run everywhere. Who knows? But it is a cyclical thing, and I think it's worth reading stuff that happened in the previous cycle. When I was trying to figure out how to improve the kind of developer testing collaboration at this kind of large company, I was reading stuff that people were writing about in the 80s and 70s, and there's lots of good material there. People today chase the current fad and always look at, you know, whatever next shiny thing gets invented. But we tend to, you know, software industry is not really old, but it's already gone through a couple of these cycles, and it's really worth looking at what people were writing about in the previous cycle to figure out what ideas can we take from there and apply in the new context.
Yeah, I agree. If you look at Frederick Brooks and or Melvin Conway, you can see those things that, oh yeah, okay, they exactly describe the problem I have now. And it was 40 or 50 years ago.
Fred Brooks said that the most difficult problem in software is deciding exactly what to build. And, you know, if you look at where most people are now, or at least people I have worked with as a consultant, the bottleneck is not in programming. The bottleneck is not in testing. The bottleneck is in product management for a lot of people now. So we came back to the most difficult thing being deciding what to build.
Exactly. It's really an interesting conversation. I'm really grateful you accepted to join the podcast today, Goiko. Is there anything else you want to share today?
Oh, I don't know. Let's leave it to this. I think it was a really enjoyable talk, and thank you very much for inviting me.
With great pleasure. Thank you, Goiko.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Le Podcast. Go to alexis.monville.com for the references mentioned in the episode, and to find more help to increase your impact and satisfaction at work. Drop a comment or an email with your feedback, or just to say hello. Until next time, to find better ways of changing your team.